Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's episode of the American College Experience. My name is Jason Haynes. I am the host of this show and also the Chief Executive Officer of the UR Tennis Network. We're so excited that you've joined us today for this live broadcast. Also excited if you picked up the podcast of this episode, which continues to grow the numbers. So excited about that. We are not going to have a guest today. We have a lot of news that I want to get out there as far as college tennis goes, just to set up the next few shows that we have lined up. But there's a lot moving in college tennis that I'll let you know about, and college sports in general, which will have an effect on tennis, and many things ongoing in the NCAA. We just finished the college football playoff, and this was an incredible event, and we want to talk about that. If you're listening in for the first time today, congratulations. We think you found the best kept secret on the internet, which is the UR Tennis Network. We do not do any advertising here on the network. We rely on you, the listener, and word of mouth to let everyone know that we are out here. And we want to thank you for doing that because it continues to grow. So we know that you are telling people about the UR Tennis Network, and we appreciate that. We are moving into our fourth year of broadcasting. We've been on the air for 4 years now, and we have over 1,500 hours worth of listening pleasure. These are interviews in which the normal media would not give you, and we have decided through our passion to offer up each week viewpoints on tennis, interviews about the tennis personalities that don't get heard from a lot, that drive this tennis world. And we spend a lot of time bringing you viewpoints that aren't normally heard from. And we're going to do some of that today in some news. We've got big college tennis news. As many of you know, we've started the spring season. Dual matches were underway, or hidden duels were underway this last weekend. I saw a lot of activity out there from the top-ranked teams in the Division I world. They were out there playing in the January weather, getting ready for the dual match season, getting some matches under their belt, letting their players wear out the rust, so to speak. And with the weather the way it was, we're glad that they have indoor facilities. As many of you know, we're in the current grips of a cold front, as we call them here in Texas, although it's been here for about 2 weeks now, and we definitely want to see some warmer weather. I think the biggest news that's coming out of college tennis is the fact that David Benjamin, the executive director and CEO of Intercollegiate Tennis, has announced his retirement, and he's going to retire in July. There is a search committee that has been formed. An executive search firm will assist in the hiring process for his successor. Just want to let you know that I haven't received any calls to help college tennis get back on track, and I'll anxiously be awaiting that executive firm to find me and put me in charge of college tennis, because I think we can right this ship before it gets too far off course. Benjamin here at the ITA began in 1979 when he was elected the president of the ITA while he was the head coach at the Princeton University of the men's and women's team, or director and head men's tennis coach. He was a 26-year career coach at Princeton. He guided them to several titles. He started the governing body of collegiate tennis. Just so you know, the ITA oversees activities of all men's and women's collegiate varsity players, including national and regional tennis competitions, singles, doubles, and teams rankings, a comprehensive awards program, and an annual coaches convention, amongst other wide variety of activities. They list that it is an allied institution of the NCAA, and also enjoys significant partnership with the USTA. It also works closely with the PTA and the PTR while interacting with the WTA, ATP, and the World Team Tennis. Benjamin was responsible for bringing corporate sponsorship to the ITA, listing out some of those: Rolex Watch USA, Campbell Soup, Volvo, Wilson Sporting Goods, DuPont, Omni Hotels, Adidas, Fila, Nike, Head, and Reebok. David is a controversial figure in the tennis world, and I say that with the utmost respect. While I was at Lee College, the ITA was very helpful in getting us on track and helping us to get the rankings out there for the JUCO system. And amongst other things, we got to travel to all-star lunches. Got to participate in the National Small College Championship, which I believe is the greatest college sporting event, tennis event, that is. And always helpful whenever I needed advice to give them a call, and they would offer up information. And in ways, it's sad to see the founder of the ITA leave at such a critical time. The ITA is undergoing lots of changes in regards to scoring systems at the Division I level. It's been quite controversial, and we're going to talk about that in just a little while. But David was the one that sat in these meetings. He may not have had a voice, but he sat in these meetings and offered up what advice he could off the record. These controversial changes are affecting college tennis currently, all in regards to hoping to get more TV time for college tennis, which in my opinion doesn't really amount to much, because the college tennis TV market doesn't seem to be budding with an explosion of want. It seems to be a filler of some kind, and we're deeply saddened by that, because it is changing college tennis as we know it, most notably the doubles, shortening that to a six-game set format, all in the hopes of getting more TV time. As I was talking the other day, I can't really understand the changes, and I'll go over them in more detail here in just a little bit, but why don't I do that? Just so everybody knows what those changes are going to be. The scoring changes happened at the ITA convention. It was a controversial the first year it started. It is even more controversial the second year, and now here we are with what has happened. The ITA shortened format that they're going with, and this is mostly coming from the Power Five conferences, and we'll talk about them shortly because they're in the news as well. But the SEC, the Big 12, the Big 10, the ACC, and the Pac-12 have all decided to shorten college tennis and the volunteers. The people that actually come because they want to come, they would like to see shorter tennis matches. The ITA shortened format, which will include no ad scoring in both the singles and doubles, and I really don't have an issue with that. I hate to see the regular scoring leave. As a conservative in this game, it really hurts to see some of these competitive juices not be allowed to be explored to their fullest, in regards to being able to play a match out the way it's intended, with regular scoring. Three doubles matches played, each match one set to six with the tiebreaker 6-all. And I was having a conversation with a person just the other day about this. I'm not real sure how long those two games, possibly four games, can take. On average, you know, about 5 minutes. So we're looking at between 10 and 20 minutes here at the most. Remember, it was an eight-game pro set, and everyone seemed to be just fine with that, particularly the small colleges and the smaller Division I's. It prepared everyone for a great dual match. Lasted about an hour, and then you moved into the singles. The doubles will be followed by a brief intermission time to be determined by six singles matches, each two out of three sets with tiebreaks at 6-all. And then the kicker, no warm-up with opponents in doubles and in singles. And I'm sure that this takes 10 minutes. And this will put more people in the stands. This is a controversial format. It'll be used during the 2015 kickoff weekend and the 2015 ITA Division I National Men's and Women's Team Indoor Championship. The committee also adopted 30 yes, 0-4-4 extensions, the shortened format for all non-conference dual match competitions, with all singles matches being played to completion. Doubles will remain clinch. It should be noted that NCAA conference rules supersede ITA rules, and therefore any conferences can decide not to play the ITA format if they do so, if they wish. And my guess is a lot of college coaches out there are going to avoid this format. It just doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of tennis to be played. I imagine that they'll allow the warm-ups. I'm not too sure about the no-add-add scoring. That'll be interesting to keep abreast. And we'll just see what happens with all that. The ITA Operating Committee felt that it was very important for Division I men's and tennis to play with the same format. Remember last year they tried two distinctly different formats, kind of brought those together, and came up with this one format, and it was said that it would enhance the student-athlete experience, be more fan-friendly, be more exciting, and make college tennis more relevant, and those have yet to be proven. The student-athlete experience is being shortened here. Remember, they're no longer playing longer tennis matches to build more character. It's being shortened here as kind of a first one to get to type situation, more of a race against the clock than an experience on court. And we're sad to see that. Make college tennis more relevant. That's the most interesting piece here, because we all know college tennis is a great experience. We know that watching college tennis matches is a great experience, particularly the longer ones, because those are the ones that bring more to it, more excitement, more fan participation. It's the close matches, the longer matches, that are actually more exciting, not the shorter ones. Benjamin, in this approach, said over the past several years, the ITA Division I member coaches have engaged in a vigorous and dynamic dialogue about format and the best ways to grow and promote the sport of college tennis. We are very proud of the way in which all our coaches of men's and women's tennis programs from widely diverse institutions have managed to work together and present a unified front on such a complicated and critical issue. And we know that to be false, because of our other host here, Chuck Creasy. Chuck has done a wonderful job, and he's going to come on the air next week to let us know about this ITA shortened format. But we know that his measures have been met and repelled in trying to bring more college tennis to the college campus by lengthening the matches. Instead, the ITA and its operating committee, and we're not quite sure who all's on that operating committee, but there are going to be a lot of interesting characters that have to answer for shortening college tennis. It brought the ire of one of the most notable college tennis parents, and that person there was Wayne Bryan. And Wayne Bryan responded to the ITA college format change. And those of you that don't get Wayne's letter, I'll read some of it to you, just the highlights here, just so we can talk about it a little bit. Wayne mentions that he's a big college tennis supporter through the years in all kinds of ways. And he says the doubles point has always been the most exciting part of a college match. He's very upset with the format, the way they've changed it. He likes the idea of eliminating warm-ups and eliminating the break between the singles and doubles. But obviously, being the head honcho in the Bryan family, he holds himself pretty close to doubles. He states that 80% of matches played in America on Saturday morning at 10 in any club, park, or school are doubles matches. He says, with promotion, programming, and coaching for doubles, we would greatly increase the number of kids coming to tennis and staying in tennis. Doubles gives our sport more width and breadth. Doubles is fun for juniors, and it really rounds out skills and teaches additional life lessons. And here's the big thing. Some youngsters just love the team thing, and he's right about that. And I agree wholeheartedly with this. Tennis is not an individual sport on the college setting. It's a team sport. It is a team that drives the competition. What does your team do on any given day in a dual match? Not a group of individuals, but a team. And we're eliminating team experiences in this, too, because those long matches, and if any of you have been to college tennis matches, these long matches are the ones that help teams come together because they live and die with every point on the court. I can remember some of our great matches against our rivals at Lee that when it got down to that one match, we would have all the players come on the court. I mean, they had to back away from the center line, but or sometimes it was a full court sideline. But these were exciting times. I mean, we would sit on the sideline and somewhat armchair coach what was going on amongst ourselves and try to encourage our players as often as we could, cheering every shot or every point, making sure that they knew that we were on the sidelines there to get things done for them in ways that they didn't think they could do. To inspire, to motivate, to create an atmosphere of excitement while being only about 30 feet away. Wayne says that we've got it all wrong. Excuse me. He says that we should feel the stands first and get off this tennis infatuation, tennis TV infatuation, and then move to live streaming. And that's an interesting way to put it, because I don't just think that the college tennis world is ready for 100,000 views TV time on a USC-UCLA college tennis match. I don't know how far away we are from actually getting that. But it seems far off, doesn't it? I mean, 100,000 views, even 50,000 views of a college tennis match on Thursday afternoon, starting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's just not going to happen all that often, if ever. But streaming, streaming, that's a different story. Like Wayne says, why don't you work on getting the people in the stands first and then have about 100 people watching on live streaming and worry about the TV later? And he's right. I'm not so sure why we worry about TV so much. I mean, I understand the allure of it. But if we're not ready for TV, why go on TV? I mean, it's so hard to tell a college tennis match story when you have three doubles matches going on at once and six singles matches. You just don't have enough TV screen. No matter how big or small you make it, you just can't tell what's going on with six singles matches going on at one time. We know the Pac-12 is trying their best to do it. We also know the SEC has moved into the network realm. The Big Ten is going there. We know the Longhorns have their Longhorn network. And they try, at a cost of about $40,000 a day, to produce a college tennis TV match. And they're fighting for a handful of spectators. And we're really, what we're going after here is the advertising time. By being on the network, you would hope that you would get some viewers to watch the advertising. However, with the tennis, I don't know that you'll get those viewers, and I think you're just going to broadcast to dead air space. I think Wayne brings out a great point in the article. He says, ask American tennis parents and American tennis juniors how they like the glut of foreign players in college tennis in this country. He states that there's no press release for the number of foreign players on U.S. college tennis teams. He wants a press release that says the total amount of tennis scholarship dollars awarded in these harsh economic times to players from overseas whose parents do not pay a dime on taxes. To me, college tennis should be for our American kids and not for our American college coaches. And while I agree in some regards with Wayne, I also side with a lot of my college coaching friends here. We need some college tennis players that are from foreign countries. This is what makes America great. By getting these kids on our campus, bringing diversity to the campus. I mean, the college universities and themselves are trying to open up more of their systems to international players. And it doesn't seem like it's hurting anybody. They are awarding scholarships to great students who become great student athletes and fine representatives of school, although I do understand that they're not really giving back. They're not really staying, and that hurts. But they are contributing in many ways. I like what we did at the junior college format, where we limited the number of players, international players on a team, to two. It allowed for some of the top players to come over that couldn't make it academically and still participate in college tennis and still have the hope of transferring to Division I. But it gave a majority of the scholarships to American players. This format was very successful through the years and allowed for a lot of great junior tennis to be played at the college setting. And the problem is, it's not going to change. In regards to a lot of college coaches through their recruiting networks just can't seem to find the American players to attend these schools. That's what they say. They say there's just no way we can get six American kids on our team, and I disagree with that. I just think there's six American players that you believe can beat USC or UCLA, even though you may never play them. You're gearing up for what hope is laid in a playoff once you make it to the NCAA Big Dance. I just don't think they're going to change it. I think we're in a situation where the rules have been made without any real vote by the members, the people that actually participate. There hasn't been a real vote amongst the players to see how they feel, even though we were part of a group of 8,000 people that registered and signed a petition that said there's no way this should happen. And when you take all the college teams across America, you don't come up with 8,000 people. So there were a lot of people that voiced displeasure in this decision and have continued to, even though it dies down, because they realize that it's falling on deaf ears. Through the years, these protests have been met with strong arm manipulation in regards to changing the format irregardless of protests. And it comes down to those big five super conferences, the Pac-12, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the ACC, and the SEC. Again, going back to their TV. Because for what amounted to 20 years, back in the 90s, they changed this format. Everything was fine. We were getting college tennis fans in the stands. We were being creative in our approach to get more people there by offering food and halftime entertainment, so to speak. We were trying to stay away from the World Team Tennis Circus that happens, but we were trying to engage more and more fans, and we were doing so slowly, just as it should be, building something that is going to last. And now it doesn't seem to be the case. It doesn't seem that we're building. It seems that we might be tearing away at this just a little bit here by decreasing the time of a tennis match, decreasing the playing experience, and not allowing these kids to compete at their best, knowing that they only have a limited amount of time. Time on the clock, something that we never thought we'd see in a tennis match, but now it's TV time. Maybe there'll be TV commercials where we have to stop play in the middle of a match just so we can get back to it. Who knows where this is going? But we on the show, we on the network, we are opposed to these changes, and you've heard me mention that many times before. Now I'll get to two pieces here, and I touched on this just a little bit last week. But the National Collegiate Athletic Association granted a last-minute waiver to the college football playoff for a pilot program to cover travel expenses of players' families for the inaugural national championship game. And a lot of people see this as a start. Just so you understand, the CFP will be allowed to reimburse families for travel, lodging, and meals up to $1,250 a player, despite the fact that they're able to provide up to $3,000 each. This is a significant improvement on the $800 stipend that Ohio State was set out to give from its Student Opportunity Fund, which was dismissed as laughably insufficient. And I don't understand why this is going to be limited to the quote-unquote major revenue-generating sports, because this waiver is also going to go to the Division I men's and women's basketball tournaments. And the unique thing about this is they actually get $3,000 for the Final Four and $4,000 for the title game. So if you're a basketball player or parent, you get more than a football. I understand there are less players, so you have less expenses, but still, why do you even give them money in the first place? I mean, I'm sorry that you can't make it. I'm sorry that your finances didn't allow you to travel and we know you'd love to be there. But $3,000 to $4,000 covered by an NCAA institution for your family to travel to the game, and you're going to get to spend maybe an hour with them in the whole experience until you get back home, because you've got to stay with your team, got to be with your team, got to play with your team, got to eat with your team. So in essence, we're paying the parents to travel. And I understand part of you would say, well, that's great. You know, these families are getting to travel to watch their sons and daughters play in national championship games, until you realize that this waiver is not being extended into the other sports. This is just for football and basketball. And these student athletes that participate in these other sports and their families are not being treated equal either. And this, again, comes from when the five wealthiest conferences in college sports want autonomy from the NCAA, breaking free from any of the restrictions the association places on athletic compensation. So, again, the top five are driving legislation, but it doesn't pertain to the others. So it's like you have an elite group that has to play by a different set of rules than the others. The case for financial assistance for the players who comprise the Power Five conferences and who thus contribute most of the revenue-generating sports of football and basketball gained significant ground. And this was while the NCAA lawsuits were going on. The issue of pay-for-play remains divisive. The Power Five officials have promised to pursue major concessions to their athletes, including scholarships that cover the full cost of attendance and more comprehensive health care coverage. And this is where the NCAA is limited by what it can do. You're having to offer an athletic scholarship that compares to academic scholarships. And really, you can't do much except to make sure that you cover the full cost. And then the kicker that they add here is more comprehensible health care coverage. Insurance, which I can't disagree with. I believe that these student athletes should be covered by the school with as much as they put on the line day in and day out. If they need to go to the doctor, the school should pay for it, for illness or injury. Said that this is merely a drop in the bucket, and it doesn't near fully address the financial needs of college athletes. Really, what this amounts to is about 1% of the estimated $50 million bump to the revenue of the Power Five Super Conferences. It's about 0.01% of the $608 million in average annual television revenue from the CFPs. And they have a deal with ESPN for $7.3 billion over 12 years. The Power Five have announced that they have full-cost attendance scholarships, loss of value insurance, and scholarship renewal as means to even out the field here. They do have a meeting later this month to finalize autonomy, which we don't think they're going to oppose. And it will go into effect August of 2015. The NCAA is broken. This is what the article says. College sports is still a big business, and college athletes are still an exploited and unpaid labor force driving the national thirst for more athletics. This is an article that I picked up called Flying Mom to Oregon, Ohio State Game Won't NCAA Pay Debate, and that was written by Kavitha A. Davidson from BloombergView.com. just my own stint on this is that I don't think it's fair. I don't think that there should be a lot of giving different sports different rewards regardless of their revenue. Remember, college athletics is an amateur-based program. It is a non-profit organization. And now we're ending in the realm of parents. Next, it might be family and friends. Just not sure where this ends. But in ways, college sports is moving to be more like professional sports and try to keep its amateur status. And that's going to be really hard to do. I just don't see how they're going to do it without the helps of maybe some U.S. Congress legislation, maybe developing an antitrust badge to be put on the NCAA. I just don't see how that's going to work since they're an amateur organization. The next piece of news I want to let you know is, and that leads me into this, the White House is going to get more involved in the college sports debate. Another article I picked up about the NCAA, it says, "Dear White House, don't let the NCAA scam you," by Patrick Ruby, sportsvice.com. According to USA Today Sports, Obama administration officials, college athletic directors, and National Collegiate Athletic Association executives are scheduled to meet this week in Washington, D.C. But they really don't have on the agenda all the money. What they're going to talk about is preventing campus sexual assault, a previously introduced mentoring program, and other worthy, non-controversial, non-financial stuff. Well, and then they have the prospect of a presidential commission to review the state and direction of major college sports. You see, the government realizes that there's something going on here and they need to change some things. The NCAA realizes that they need to change some things. And this goes to what I said. The NCAA wants an antitrust exemption. With all the lawsuits that are facing them, they need to find a way to get out of paying money. They need something that would allow the association's member schools to keep on moving with the lucrative business of not allowing college athletes to be compensated for their market value. To get the antitrust exemption, the NCAA is going to have to convince the Obama administration as well as lawmakers on Capitol Hill how to do it. That it somehow prevents the public good, or it somehow serves the public good to prevent University of Georgia back Todd Gurley from signing his autograph for money, lest that money become taxable by the Internal Revenue Service and in a tiny way help us pay down our enormous deficit. The problem with this is there's no real good reason to support amateurism in big-time college sports. And that's what it is. There's no real reason to support amateurism anymore in big-time college sports because it's not an amateur basis. The ESPN broadcast of the college football playoff game netted its largest audience at around 38 million viewers. And I said this a long time ago, that once the football playoff system started, they would see how much money they could get off of it and get hungrier. And that's what I imagine is going to move here in the next few years. They'll extend that college football playoff system from four teams to maybe eight teams. And once they do that, with the top eight teams in the country getting a chance to play for a national title, TV executives, advertisers, college athletic directors are going to be very excited about the revenue potential. The NCAA, it says, feels threatened and pushed into a corner, which means that they're going to have to do some serious scamming, as the article claims, which means duping the general public and the federal judiciary alike with dubious math and gauzy appeals to the revered tradition of amateurism. It's based on the fact or the idea that college sports is struggling. However, the campus athletic industry is thriving. March Madness alone earns the NCAA roughly $771 million annually. Again, ESPN is paying schools $7.3 billion over 12 years for the right to broadcast the new college football playoff. USA Today reports that the athletic directors at FBS schools were paid an average of $515,000 a year. A few weeks ago, the University of Michigan lured football coach Jim Harbaugh away from the San Francisco 49ers with a $5 million annual salary, closer to $8 million with incentives and deferred compensation. Big-time college sports is growing, not shrinking. Since 1984, 12 schools have left Division I basketball, but 87 schools have joined. Seven schools departed the football bowl subdivision, while 27 have entered. The most notable school to drop recently was the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which dropped its football program. They claim the decision was rooted in basic math. Football was costing the school too much money. Remember, this goes along with the stipend that they proposed as well. It was reported to be around $2,000. But all this legislation, all this talking is gearing up for that, where these schools are going to have to make some sort of competitive bid for athletes that they already make for coaches, assistant coaches, recruiting coordinators, strength and conditioning gurus, athletic department bureaucrats, professors, and even talented postdoctoral students. The NCAA have repeatedly warned that if the athletes are allowed to enjoy the same open market for their services currently enjoyed by every other American, then universities will have to slash scholarships in other sports in order to pay for football and men's basketball. They just don't know how they're going to maintain the number of teams. Remember, the Division I school, you have to have 16 sports. But how can they field those teams if they're offering these large scholarships? Including the Olympic sport programs. And that's an interesting spin on things. No longer are they non-revenue generating, but they're Olympic sports. So just not real sure where this legislation is going to go. But we do know we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it each week that we get a chance. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes activity here that affects college tennis, and it has to do with college football and college basketball, and that's a sad state, but that's where we have to be. Until something major changes, until we get more fans in the stadiums, until we're able to get more college TV time, things aren't going to change. Things are going to keep getting shorter and shorter. And I've said it before, it looks like we'll move to world team tennis. That would be the ultimate goal here. Four, maybe five tennis players on a campus. You go into the ring, the three-ring circus. You play for about an hour and a half. You make it 3 hours long because of all the TV and the commercials. And less top American juniors go play college athletics as far as tennis goes. And that's sad. That's real sad. So, just wanted to let you know of those couple of things this week. Next week we've got the return of a live guest. We've got Coach Chuck Creasy. He'll be coming in here. He'll be talking to us about these college tennis scoring format changes. Plus, we're going to learn about his stint over there at the Citadel, what's been going on, how he's been doing over there, and what his players are up to. So we hope that you'll listen in for that. I want to thank you for listening in today. I want to thank you for listening to the network. And we'll continue to strive to bring you new programs. Go out there and hit some tennis balls if you can. The weather needs to get better to do that, though, I understand. Thank you for all. Bye-bye.